Well, good morning, America. Welcome to another episode of your favorite history show, the Sons of History podcast. I'm your co-host and my counterpart is over there. How you doing, man?
I'm well. I feel like having a bit of a deja vu.
Yeah, I know. And just for those who it's your first time listening, his name is Alan Joaquim. I wanted him to say his name himself, but you know, that's cool. I mean,
you have a better radio voice.
Hey, I appreciate that. But you actually worked in radio.
I did. Stevens and Pruitt. Those were some KLOL 101. That was the best radio station, best talk show in the country.
Well, yeah, I mean, it blew everybody away here in Houston, which is a very large city, so that's for sure. Yeah, speaking of deja vu, we are wearing our same clothes. I'd like to think that my facial hair has grown out to the same length that it was. You're wearing the same clothes that you were. We had a bit of a mishap.
Yeah, but I just realized I didn't, I got a little bit of gruff. I was clean shaven on our, when we did the episode.
Well, hopefully no one notices on the audio version.
I have a different mug too. The one I was using is dirty.
Okay, well, that's deja vu. It's not exactly how you remember it, but it's just familiar enough. Yeah, we had a little bit of a mishap. You sent over your video stuff, but before you did, you're like, hey, I'm not hearing any sound. And I was like, well, go ahead and send it anyways. And if I can't hear anything, then we'll just have to redo our intro and our exit as we do separate. But yeah, everything is as it is. Obviously, we're doing this actually a week later. I just got back from Washington, D.C. That was a great time. Thanks for asking.
Well, I just got back from San Antonio. My trip was out of this world.
Yeah, it was. You took some photos of the Ring of Fire.
Yep. I went to the path for the solar eclipse. Took some pretty cool pictures, but not as cool as some of the ones you took from your.
No. And I had a great time. Did you happen to do a seance or anything to try to bring up the spirit of Johnny Cash?
No, but the folks that I stayed with in outside of San Antonio, they had a little Stonehenge-looking seating area. It was made out of the same, well, at least looked like the same granite. It wasn't as tall, but yeah, that we did call it Stonehenge place, something, you know.
Stonehenge.
Yeah.
Did he write a song? Did he write a song called Stonehenge?
Who?
Johnny Cash.
I don't know. I played what Pink. Hold
even,
on. No. See, I thought of playing Ring of Fire, but
about?
I decided
see,
I wanted to play Pink Floyd Eclipse from the Dark Side of the Moon. So.
Interesting. Hey, I got a quick question. Can you hear anything that I'm saying?
Yes.
Okay, but you heard the Johnny Cash thing. Is that what you're telling
me? I heard
me?
The Johnny Cash thing.
And yet you said, I am not going to acknowledge it. I will burrow right into Stonehenge. Like, see, I try to, like, it's an alley-oop.
Okay.
When I throw an alley-oop, that's basketball, right?
Okay.
But you're playing some other sport. You're playing soccer, and I'm playing basketball over here. See, that's the curse and the blessing.
It doesn't surprise me at all that you play soccer, or that you're into soccer. Not at all.
I said you are playing soccer. I was playing basketball.
Not doing anything of the kind.
Anyways, so I had a great time. I was invited by Encounter Books. They are a publishing company out in New York City. And I've met a number of them. I met them last year when I went over to New York City. And they invited me to come be a special guest at their event at the National Building Museum. They're honoring the great historian, the classicist Victor Davis Hanson. So that was fantastic. Got to meet a lot of people, some people that we've had on our show. I met Wilfred McClay. You remember talking to him?
Yeah, he wrote that American history book that should be read by all students.
Exactly. Also met Batya Unger-Sargon. You remember her? She was with Newsweek.
Yeah, yes, I do remember her.
Yeah, so we got to chat it up a little bit, and a few other people. So I had a good time, and obviously I went around to some of the museums, statues, checked out the Library of Congress. Always just absolutely stunning. And so then I came home. Yeah, it's all good. And Madison was thrilled to see me. But without further ado, you ready to bring this guest on?
Yes, because this is going to be a pretty cool subject. Anytime we talk about Nathaniel Green, that's one of my favorites. Great subject.
Yeah, and it's very rare that we talk about him, but we do talk about the American Revolution quite often. However, this is one of those major players within the American Revolution that doesn't get his just due. At least that's the way I think you and I feel.
Well, you know, he helped win the American Revolution. He won the South. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about this, and I don't think there are any historians that would say otherwise. So and he needs the you know, there's a lot of people who don't sit and even think about the battles that were fought in the South. They think about you know, what George Washington went through, and but you know, there were two key players that I do want to mention when we talk to her. I have to pretend like we haven't spoken to her, even though this is a week later. So forgive me on that part. But I've always stated that there were two generals in the American Revolution that won the war for us: Benedict Arnold in the North and Nathaniel Greene in the South. So
yeah, and it'll be interesting when you quote unquote ask her that question.
Yes, I can't wait to hear what she has to say.
Exactly. All right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, our very special guest is Selina Baker. She is an award-winning historical fiction author and American Revolution and Victorian America historian. She has presented at events such as History Camp, our friends over at Valley Forge, as well as Authors of the American Revolution Congress at Washington Crossing Historic Park. Her latest book, which is the topic of our conversation, is entitled The Line of Splendor, a novel of Nathaniel Greene and the American Revolution. So without further ado, we've got Selina Baker on the line. Yes, we do. Selina, how are you doing?
Good, good. Thanks for having me, guys. I really appreciate it.
We're happy to have you. We can't wait to have this conversation. We love discussing the American Revolution and just the various people who played a role in it, for good or for ill. I know Alan has an affinity for traitors like Benedict Arnold. He's a big fan. I don't understand it. I don't get it. I don't want to get it. But nonetheless,
I have made no such moves towards people like Alger Hiss or the Rosenbergs, but you know, come on, Benedict Arnold, he got shafted, in my opinion. The Congress wasn't cool to him, and Gates and Ethan Allen took all the credit for his work. So yeah, of course I'm gonna be, you know, I don't, yeah, hey, listen, I believe in forgiving Judas, so there you go.
Well, okay. Yeah, whatever. I don't think he got shafted. I thought he got shot twice in the same leg.
He did.
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah, but he got shafted by our guys.
Oh, we're
I know a lot of people that are sympathetic toward Benedict Arnold, so you're in good company.
Yeah, there you go. We're all talking metaphorically, of course, yes. Hey, so Selina, my first question regarding Nathaniel Greene is, how did Nathaniel Greene go from being a Quaker to helping win winning the Southern Theater of Operations in the Revolutionary War? And also, while you're at it, regarding the Quaker aspect of him, tell us a little bit as well about his upbringing.
He was born in Rhode Island, and he was the fourth son of a Quaker preacher and a prosperous businessman. And his dad, him and his brothers, their education was limited to reading, writing, and math because their father thought book learning beyond that led to temptation and sin. And as Nathaniel was growing up, like any teenager, he did a lot of things he wasn't supposed to do, like jumping out of his bedroom window and sneaking off to dances. And, you know, just some of that rebellious teenage stuff that was happening, just like it happens now. What he did do that really got him in trouble was when he was 31, he went to a place in Connecticut, a questionable place, as the friends called it. He and his cousin Griffin, they supposedly either went to a tavern or they went to a tavern and a military parade. So they were put on probation, meaning they were kicked out of the meetings, and neither Nathaniel nor Griffin would confess to what they did. And then he also started using legal words that were kind of military-like. He was trained in doing some legal things because of the business he helped his father run. And he went to plays. These things were definitely looked down on by the Quaker community.
Very interesting. So how did he go from, 'cause Quakers are more of not the violent type. So how did he go from saying I'm a Quaker and then jumping into I'm going to get involved in this war?
He mostly, like everybody else at the time, he was outraged by the acts that Parliament were passing, and interfering with colonial autonomy. And one of the things that set him off was he and his brothers owned a ship called Fortune, and a British naval officer named William Duddingston confiscated the Fortune for smuggling, which they were smuggling. They were trying to avoid the Navigation Act taxes. So when Duddingston did that, Nathaniel Green sued him, which is another thing the Quakers didn't approve of. This was one of the incidences that led to the burning of the Gaspee in June 1772. He was accused of participating, but he did not participate. But they threatened to arrest him and send him to London for trial. So he was set off by this, and then as things began to roll and these different acts began to happen, he just got more and more involved with the outrage throughout the colonies.
Well, now he served as a quartermaster general, and he did fight in many engagements, such as I'm going to list them off here. He was in Trenton, Princeton, Brandywine, Monmouth. By the way, I went to the when I was at Monmouth, there was a big quote from him stating,
Inside the visitor center.
"We have to attack. We can't just let the British Army go without attacking." But that was at Monmouth, which I think is an underrated battle. He was at the Battle of Rhode Island, Harlem Heights, but other than Springfield, he did not really, distinguish himself like Benedict Arnold or Daniel Morgan or even John Glover, who another person who doesn't get enough credit. So, and he was the one, in fact, that told Washington that we needed to keep our men stationed at Fort Washington, and the end result by not evacuating the men. All 3,000 were either killed or captured.
Right.
So, what was it about Greene that convinced George Washington that he should lead the Southern War Department even before Horatio Gates got his ass kicked at Camden?
I get asked that a lot, and there's really no hard evidence about why Washington and Nathaniel Greene became so close and why Washington trusted him no matter what. They had a few things in common. They were both did not have a formal education. They were both totally dedicated to the cause. Neither one of them went home or took furlough, or they were there the entire war together. And Nathaniel Greene was always, Washington can count on him to do everything. And like you said, he was a quartermaster and he did an excellent job, although he hated it. He did it anyway, and he could just depend on him to step forward and do his best.
Okay, so all right. So as I mentioned, we had the Battle of Camden. Got a lot of good men killed. So he's sent down to the Southern War Department, or he's now the Southern War Department because after what happened at Charleston, there really wasn't anything down there. But he took with him a great supporting cast, such as Henry Lighthorse Harry Lee. Baron von Steuben, and I'm
Yes.
going to butcher his name, Thaddeus Kosciusko,
I can never pronounce his name. He was already down there, and so was Otho Holland Williams was already down there. Steuben was his second in command, but he never made it to the South. He only made it as far as Virginia.
Okay. And I'll mention, I call them the trifecta, Francis Marion, Andrew Pickens, and Thomas
and
Sumter.
Tom Sumter.
And we'll get to them on a later question regarding the guerrilla war that took place down there. But Daniel Morgan. Now, Daniel Morgan was under his command, and he did the Battle of Cowpens, the double envelopment, wiped out Lieutenant Colonel Bannister Tarleton. And many compare, you know, this battle, the Battle of Cowpens, to the Battle of Cannae when Hannibal Carthage wiped out 8 Roman legions.
Right.
So let's talk a little bit about, you know, what happened. Let's talk about, let's say, the Battle of Cowpens. Tell us, and his great supporting cast, as I called it.
Well, when he got down there, he found his army in Charlotte. In December 1780, Horatio Gates is there. Even though he had ridden off to Hillsborough, North Carolina after the Battle of Camden, he was back. He was with his army. They had a peaceful transfer of power. They were cordial to one another. But when Nathaniel got down there, there was already people down there. Like you said, the Polish engineer. How do you say his last name? Kuszkowski.
I'll say, let's just say, we'll say Kosciuszko.
Yeah, he was down there already. Daniel Morgan was already there because he had gone to support Gates. So he was there. Otho Holland Williams from Maryland, Colonel Otho Holland Williams was there. John Eager Howard was there from Maryland. Light Horse Harry Lee didn't come down there till January 1781. Washington sent him down there. When Nathaniel got down there, Cornwallis has 4,000 men about 70 miles south in Winnsboro, South Carolina. And Nathaniel's army is 2,300 men. Only 800 are armed and fit. So he has to make a decision. What am I going to do? These guys are shoeless. They're ragged. They've been through hell. It's a, you know, horrible situation. So that's when he decided to divide his army. And he went against every military doctrine that said, you don't divide your army in the face of a superior foe. So he sent Daniel Morgan in Northwest South Carolina. And then Nathaniel marched his army down into South Carolina to Chera. So, of course, Cornwallis sends, like you said, Bannister Tarleton after Morgan to rid the countryside of him. And that's when they end up clashing at the Cowpens. This is when he formed his men in three lines. John Eager Howard was one of the top commanders there during that battle. Colonel William Washington was also already in the South, and that was his cavalry was there at Cowpens with Morgan as well. And Tarleton literally ended up fleeing the battle.
Okay, well, I know that. I think Dustin, I think you're going to bring up the next subject, the significance of the Battle of Cowpens. We captured a lot of guys. I remember that one. So
yes, captured a lot of guys. Gave it a lot of morale. There was a lot of morale, but the aftermath of Cowpens was distressing on the Southern Army. But the significance of Cowpens gave them hope that things could change. Between Nathaniel Greene coming down there and what happened at Cowpens, it was a big boost for the Southern Army.
So the race to the Dan, many consider that really Greene's greatest victory, right? So you have, we just mentioned like the Cowpens victory, taking a ton of British prisoners. But it's pushed Cornwallis far from their logistical support. So in their pursuit, Cornwallis decides to burn the wagons in order to speed up the chase, which sort of makes sense. But tell our audience about the race to the Dan, and including the taunting that took place when the British arrived at the Dan River? And then also, do you think that this is how this wound up working out? Do you sort of see it as sort of a Fabian strategy that Greene utilized?
The race to the dam was definitely a Fabian strategy. He, after Cowpens, Cornwallis went after them. Nathaniel sent his army to rendezvous at Salisbury, North Carolina. Nathaniel goes to support Morgan. They begin to retreat towards Salisbury. This is when the Cornwallis began to chase him at the very first. Nathaniel shifts his army's junction to go for Courthouse. They meet up there. That's when they decide they're going to go to Virginia, North Carolina, Virginia border, and cross the Dan River. I'm sorry. What was the rest of the question?
If you think it was the Fabian strategy, but sort of explain what the race to the Dan was all about.
They went there to preserve their army. They felt like they could get some rest when they went across into Virginia, that they might be closer to some supply lines when they went into Virginia. The thing that they were worried about, though, was leaving the Carolinas and having the Patriots, the civilian Patriots militia, think that they had abandoned them. So they had to weigh those two things to make a decision. Was it more important for Nathaniel to preserve his army and give himself a chance to breathe and think about what to do next? Or was it more important to say, we're leaving the Carolinas and hopefully everybody knows we'll be back? So he decided it was more important to rest his army after everything that had happened. You know, they did this retreat from Cowpens all the way to go for Courthouse. It was exhausting. There were battles along the way, minor battles along the way. And he knows Cornwallis' army is exhausted and starving as well because he's burned his baggage train. They don't have tents. They're scrounging for food. And I think it was an excellent decision on his part because Cornwallis couldn't get across the Dan at his army. Nathaniel Greene had taken every boat in the Roanoke Valley when Cornwallis pulled up to the Dan River in February 1781, and he couldn't get across.
Was there taunting involved?
There was taunting involved. There was always taunting involved. Every time Cornwallis tried to cross a river that Greene's army had already crossed, there was always taunting involved. But not as much as there was when he was trying to cross the other rivers, the Catawba or Catawba, and some of those others that he was trying to cross getting to Greene before he even got to Guilford Courthouse. There was more taunting then.
Well, you know, I know, you know, General Greene, you know, he lost a lot of battles, but he won the war overall. Mm-hmm. He was not involved with King's Mountain. And mm-hmm. Now, Cowpens, he wasn't in command. That was Daniel Morgan, even though Morgan reported to Greene. But he lost at Cowan's Ford. He lost at Hobkirk's Hill, lost at 96, lost at Eutaw Springs, and he lost at Guilford Courthouse. But Guilford Courthouse, that's really a very important battle. If you could, you know, tell our audience a little bit about what happened at Guilford Courthouse, because as far as we know, Greene did use Morgan's tactics, and Morgan was sick at this time and he was out of the war.
Morgan was gone back to Virginia.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So he used Morgan's tactics of the three lines, but my understanding is that he lost that battle when Cornwallis began firing artillery into all the fighting men who were entangled together, both British and American. And I'll ask the second question after you discuss the Guilford Courthouse.
Yeah, after Nathaniel came back into North Carolina, his army swelled from about 2,500 men to about 4,500 because he got thousands of new militiamen in some Continentals from Virginia. And so he went back to Guilford Courthouse. He liked the lay of the land there, whatever reason he had for it. He did line his men up into three lines. I believe it was North Carolina militia. Behind them was Virginia militia, I and then the regulars, Maryland, Delaware, his base, Continentals, were behind that. The problem was that the area was wooded on both sides. There were streams, there were cornfields. It was harder for his lines to see one another. Cornwallis approaches, comes up a road, and immediately they start artillery fire. And Nathaniel's lines fall apart. The North Carolina line falls apart. The next line falls apart. William Washington is coming in. Banners of Tarleton didn't do a lot in the beginning. He just came up the road. But Nathaniel's cavalry comes in. Cornwallis's lines begin to approach the Continentals, the Delaware, Maryland guys. And so there is talk that Cornwallis turned cannon on his own men to just break the line, right? But what happened was Charles O'Hara's men came in, Alexander Leslie's men came in, the British regiments there, and they started attacking the Marylanders and in the Delaware's line. And at this point is where everybody says Cornwallis turned his cannon on his own men. Now, I've read a lot of stuff about it. I'm not an expert. But there are some historians who disagree that he did that. And there are some who say he did do that. So I don't know if that was really the deciding factor of the battle. I would say more it was Leslie and O'Hara coming in on him and attacking his lines. But that was my more, that's my interpretation. That's what I could see happening.
Yeah, because it reminded me a little bit about the, was it Braveheart, when at the Battle of Falkirk, when Longshanks fired the arrows into his own men that were entangled with William Wallace's.
Yeah, I was thinking that too.
Yeah, so, all right, now, the significance of the Battle of Guilford Courthouse. You mentioned Cornwallis was exhausted. He marched to Wilmington, North Carolina, then north up to Virginia to meet his fate at Yorktown.
Yes.
He abandons the South, and the guerrilla warfare campaign managed to isolate British and Loyalist strongholds. And here's where those three men, the trifecta that I mentioned earlier, Francis Marion, Andrew Pickens, and Tom Sumter. Mm-hmm. Is it Sumter? Sumter. I don't know if I got
it. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't
He's
know
buried in
that.
The high hills of Santee, South Carolina.
Uh-huh. So, yeah, but I mean, you know, people want, you know, if you're going to go to Guilford Courthouse, you got to know this was a very significant battle which changed the entire Southern strategy in the theater of operations.
Right, because once Cornwallis was gone, the primary, of course, the British are holding Wilmington, Charleston, and Savannah. But outside of those three cities, Cornwallis is the only large force out there. And once he's gone, the British outposts now are Nathaniel's prey. He turns to South Carolina and says, we're going to attack these outposts and we're going to start locking the British in Charleston so that they can't get out and forge and do what they need to do. He depends a lot on Francis Marion, Thomas Sumter, and Andrew Pickens. Andrew Pickens was also at Cowpens. I believe he was promoted to a general for that battle. Thomas Sumter was a little bit uncooperative at times. He could be quite uncooperative, as a matter of fact. Francis Marion and Andrew Pickens were much more cooperative and did a lot more operating under Nathaniel's orders than Sumter did. I'm not saying Sumter wasn't great. He was. It's just that he and Nathaniel had problems which would bloom after he died, which is a whole nother story. So Nathaniel called in his militia and they began to, the first outpost they attacked was Camden. And Lord Francis Rawdon has 900 loyalists and British soldiers garrisoned there. Nathaniel pulls up to the walls of Camden and is too strong for his small force to attack. So they pull back to Hobkirk's Hill, which is about 2 miles north. And they're relaxing. They're in order of battle. But on April 25th, Rodden attacks him. And Rodden approaches in this narrow line. Nathaniel Green's like, we got him. We're going to be able to flank these guys, whatever. His infantry rolls forward, Maryland on one side, Virginia on the other. William Washington's doing his, you know, cavalry stuff. And what happened was the Maryland line bowed during the battle, and they fell back. And it caused the Virginia regiments to fall back. So Nathaniel called a retreat, and he was furious because he blamed this Maryland line bowing and not being able to get back in the formation on Maryland Colonel John Gumby. And he had Gumby court-martialed, although I think Gumby was found not guilty. But this battle really infuriated Green because he thought for sure they had it won. But he didn't stop. He wasn't. He sent Light Horse Harry Lee and Francis Marion to start attacking all the different outposts: Fort Mott, Fort Granby. Sumner was attacking Fort Granby as well. Then in May of 1781, Nathaniel himself attacks 96, and they don't really attack. They pull up to 96, and this is in western South Carolina. There's a fort there called the Star Fort. There is another fort there, and it's a town, and it's a fortified town. He pulls up with his army. They've been marching through horrible rain. It's been a long march. And they begin the siege. And Kuskowski, his engineer, and I said it wrong again, started laying out trenches. They pretty much started right away. And he laid the person out too close. And immediately, the commander of 96, Colonel John Kruger, sends this bunch of guys out there to attack him. And so they start over again and start the trenches further back. And every night, Kruger sends guys out there to attack Nathaniel Green's sappers. And they lose their equipment and they get killed. And there's mosquitoes during the day. And it's just a horrible, exhausting situation. Well, Nathaniel finds out that Lord Francis Rodden is coming up from Charleston, and he's marching toward 96 to put a stop to this. But at this point, communication's been cut off between 96 and Charleston because of Nathaniel's relentless sending out the militia to stop these little groups of foragers or this or that and the other. So Kruger doesn't know Rodden's coming, not at first. Nathaniel needs to get the siege going and get it done. It's not going good. Finally, he realizes that it's useless after a month. He says, we're leaving, we're retreating. Here comes Rodden. He's going to be here any day. His guys say, we don't want to. We want to attack. And he lets him do it. And he said, you got to be a volunteer. I'm not risking my whole army. So he has a forlorn hope. They attack Star Fort, the walls of the fort. And it's terrible. Kruger sallies forth a couple of times. The guys are attacked. They're killed. Nathaniel calls a retreat because so many guys have already died. And Rodden pulls up to 96 a couple days later.
Now, I am the belief, but I want to get your opinion on this. Is it safe to say that, you know, the United States was saved by Benedict Arnold in the first 4 years of the Revolutionary War, Nathaniel Greene, the last 4 years of the Revolutionary War, and George Washington from the end of the Revolutionary War until the end of his second term? What do you think? Agree, disagree? What are your thoughts?
Do I agree that could have happened?
That's my assumption, that Benedict Arnold saved the country in the first 4 years of the war, Green the last four in Washington. Because I feel like every person, all three of those men were at the right place at the right time. Because Washington, I think any of our guys could have, I think any of them could have won the war. Because Washington, his tactics were not the best. And it wasn't his idea to go to Yorktown. He wanted to attack New York.
Yeah, I know Rochambeau and those guys want to do that. Yeah.
So, you know, I'm not going to sit there and say that, you know, Washington won the Revolutionary War himself without the efforts of Arnold and Greene, but because of his placement as the commander in chief, that when he submitted his resignation and went back to his plantation, that, you know, his behavior, the Cincinnati behavior, the way he just quit. He didn't become the king. He didn't become the president, but he was there when it became obvious that the Articles of Confederation were not working. We needed something a little bit stronger. All three men were at the right place at the right time. That's my belief. What are your thoughts on that? Do you feel anything different? Do you think that, you know, that has merit? I mean, someone in your position, what do you think? What are your thoughts on?
On what I think it would have gone differently than what you've just said, or do I agree with what you just said?
That's the question.
That's the
I want to know what's in your head. What are your thoughts?
Wow, I didn't get a chance to think about that at all.
See, you know, that's Mike Wallace or Ted Koppel. That's the kind.
Yeah, thanks there.
Do
You think Alan's
I
getting?
agree with the Washington part for sure. Washington wasn't that great with tactics. I think he was a good leader as far as people liked him or believed in him. But I don't think Washington won the war either. And Benedict Arnold was on his way to possibly doing the 4 years, first 4 years of the war, winning that. He was on his way. You do know Nathanael Greene oversaw the tribunal of John Andre, right?
Yes.
Okay.
He was there. He was there for that one.
I can't help say that. Nathanael Greene, if any general could have won the last 4 years of the war, it was him, especially if he had been the commander in chief of the army. He was as relentless as Arnold Greene was, even though he didn't come swooping into the Bremen Redoubt and get shot. He was still as relentless. No matter what he did, he didn't let up. He didn't stop. His court years as quartermaster general attested that. He and Congress battled it out like nobody's business. And Greene had the fortitude to stand up and say, "This is not going right," or "This is ridiculous. It needs to be like this. It needs to be like this." He had the mental fortitude to do that more than I think Arnold had more of the actual physical brawn to do it, along with him thinking through things. So I agree with you. I really do agree with what you were trying to say there.
Hey, look at that, Alan.
All right. Hey, I'll consider that a great compliment.
Feeling good about things. Speaking of feeling good about things, the opposite of feeling good about things. So shortly after the war ends, Nathanael Greene dies. So what are the details of a post-American Revolutionary War Nathanael Greene? The war ends, and he's got a lot of post-war debt, not able to pay his men. He passes away in 1786. What are the details of Nathanael Greene after the war?
It's really, in my opinion, it's really sad. He was very sensitive to criticism as well. But that's a whole different, that's not the question you asked. When the British evacuated Charleston in 1782, he of course came in and took over, and was there for a while, and he wasn't getting money. He was getting money from some of the other states to clothe his men, but it was worthless in South Carolina. So he didn't have money to clothe or provide for his men. He got some notes from the Robert Morris, the superintendent of finance, to spend and permission from Benjamin Lincoln, who was the Secretary of War, to buy clothes for his troops through whoever he could find down in Charleston. So he does this and he finds this Charleston. Only one person will sell him army clothes. This is this guy named John Banks. He's a merchant, he's a speculator. Nathaniel says, okay. John Banks, Nathaniel pays him some money. John Banks takes the money and he speculates with it. Well, it somehow involves the British and tea from the West Indies and just some, I can't remember the exact same details right off the top of my head. Congress finds out that Banks has speculated this money and they don't send any more money to Nathaniel. They won't pay Banks creditors. Banks says, I'm not giving you any more provisions or clothing for your army, General Greene, until I get a guarantee. What does Nathaniel do? He signs a guarantee for £30,000. He doesn't have this money, but he's thinking he's going to get it possibly after the war. Although he really should have known better, considering no one's getting paid. That I can't speculate on exactly what he was thinking because we don't know. But what he was thinking was, I need to take care of my army. We know this. So he went to these extremes to do this by signing a £30,000 note. Well, John Banks ends up losing everything. He goes bankrupt. And now these companies want their money from Nathaniel Greene, and he doesn't have it. However, he was awarded plantations by the state of Georgia and South Carolina and land in North Carolina. He has those things, but he doesn't really have the money to run them properly, and he doesn't know what he's doing. He has no home in Rhode Island. Him and Katie have nowhere to live. He has four children. When the war is over, he goes home to Rhode Island. He's destitute. The creditors are hounding him for money. He has to borrow money from Robert Morris, the Marquis de Lafayette, Colonel Jeremiah Wadsworth, who is a friend and business partner. And of course, him and Katie end up having another kid. They decide they're going to move to Mulberry Grove Plantation in Georgia. Of course, this takes money, worked land, whatnot. He also buys land on Cumberland Island, Georgia, as an investment. And he's having trouble finding someone to work to cut the timber there so he can sell it. The whole thing is a mess. And so he and Katie move to Savannah, Georgia. He leaves his family behind. He never sees them again. Never goes back to Rhode Island again. And they set up housekeeping at Mulberry Grove Plantation. It needs a lot of work. He's paid people to fix this place up so they can live there, but he still has no money and his creditors are still hounding him. And there's no money forthcoming from Congress to pay him what he needs. So they set up there and he went to Savannah, Georgia on June 11th, 1786. He and Katie did to meet with one of these creditors that was hounding him to death about money. It was actually a firm in London, and the guys come there to see Nathaniel Greene in person. Nathaniel goes and meets him, and the meeting's a failure. Then they go back again. So on the last trip to Savannah, on the way home, he and Katie stop at a friend's house, and Nathaniel walks the fields with this neighbor. They talk about the farming and whatnot, but Nathaniel doesn't wear a hat, and it's June in the South. On the way home, he complains he has a headache. A few days later, his forehead swells, and his pain in his eyes and intensifies, and he becomes unresponsive. So of course they call a doctor, they bleed him, they blister him. They send the kids to a neighbor's house. And General Anthony Wayne was also awarded land by the state of Georgia, and he's his neighbor, literally his next door neighbor. Anthony Wayne arrives And he and Katie hold vigil, and Nathaniel stops breathing on the morning of June 19th, 1786. And he was 46, 43. So it was, and he leaves behind a 31-year-old wife and five children, ages 2 through 10. And it's where it was a tragic, senseless death.
Now, I don't know the symptoms. What is that? Like, how did he die? What was the...
Oh, I'm sorry. He had sunstroke. He was diagnosed with sunstroke.
Oh, snap.
Yeah, I thought I said that. I'm sorry. I'm thinking in my head too fast there. Yeah, he was diagnosed with sunstroke. And of course, they could have saved him today, but bleeding and blistering someone for sunstroke is worthless. And
yeah, no, yeah, that's true. I never mind. I was going to try to make a joke, but there's nothing there.
No.
Yeah, it's a tragic story. In a different light than the one that we referenced earlier with Benedict Arnold, right? It's like
right.
So. Last question. So there's a famous line from Abraham Lincoln, and he says, "Don't believe everything you read on the internet." And so there's a famous line supposedly from Nathaniel Green that says, "We fight, get beat, rise, and fight again." Did he really say that?
Yes, he did. He wrote that to, the Marquis de Lafayette, right after the Battle of Hobkirk's Hill. And actually, the rest of it says, "We have a bloody field, but little glory." Most people don't know that part of the line or don't repeat it. He also wrote the same thing to one of the French ministers of that was here in the United States. That same famous line. And that's the line I have on my bookmarks. So,
hey, there we go. Proof is in the pudding.
I'm going to ask you now, your book that's coming out, what's the date? Is it?
It released October 12th.
So how does this book tie in with Nathaniel Green? Is there a certain part of is it the campaigning? Is it his life?
It's a biographical novel of his life. Actually, though, starts when he's 28. And then there's a little flashback to his childhood, not doesn't jump you straight into it, but just him talking with his brothers and kind of in ages in the childhood part of it. But it starts when he's older.
Well, is there anything that you want to mention or bring up that you think is important regarding Nathaniel Green?
That I think is important. I think that he basically won the Revolutionary War for us by chasing Cornwallis into Yorktown. I think that it's sad that that people don't know who he is, how important he was, and what he sacrificed for this country. And he has a beautiful monument in Savannah that he's buried under in Johnson Square. He, the Society of Cincinnati, Rhode Island, looked for his coffin in vaults in Colonial Cemetery in Savannah. It was lost. They didn't know where he was buried. They found him, and his son George was buried with him. George drowned when he was 18. And I wanted to write a novel because I wanted people to hear his voice, not just read a history book. And I'm not saying not just read a history book in that context. I don't mean that because I have my whole office is full of nonfiction history books. I just wanted him to be seen as a man with a family and children and a lot more to lose than just a war.
Well, all right, Alan. I know you could go for two more years.
I could too.
Yeah, I'm quite certain.
Come on, we're talking about Nathaniel Green here. Guy,
Well, hey, you know what, Alan? If it wasn't for me, our episodes would never be over. Like we would only have one episode and people would parachute in as we are talking and we would have IVs connected to us to keep us alive.
Well, I've seen Joe Rogan go about 2 hours.
Well, you're no Joe Rogan, man. And you're never gonna be. No matter how much you work out.
I listen, I go to UFC fights. In fact, you know, I did UFC for a while.
Yes, I know. I know.
But it was a while ago. So.
Right. But get in the ring. Get in the competitive.
Do you have your outfit?
In fact, I do. I've got the shoes. I have one of my shoes still sitting here. I have my cup and the, yeah, I had to wear a cup. And this was back in the day before they start. When I was doing it, there were no rules. This is when you could punch a guy right in the, the jewels. And so I had to wear a cup. And I wore something. I had the boxing gloves, so, but not real boxing gloves. It's definitely a lot thinner. But yeah, that was a interesting moment of my life.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
But I was not supposed to talk about it. That was like the first and second rule.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, you don't talk about it. Next episode.
Talk about Fight Club.
Next episode, be sure to wear your outfit. I'd like to see that.
Well, I mean, we're talking about a jock strap.
Yeah, I know. That's what I'm talking about.
I don't know if you want me sitting in that.
That's what I'm talking about. I mean, all right, Selena, we could keep you here all day, but we're not going to because one of us is a gentleman. But thank you again for, and I'm referencing myself. Thank you again for joining us. We look forward to your book coming out. I know it's going to have great success. So thank you again for all that you're doing to bring to light stories of the American Revolution, but also a very, very important, influential, and successful figure during the American Revolution. And to your point, and to Alan's point, chances are we may not have won, or at least not as won as early without him. So thank you again.
Thank you so much, Alan, Dustin. I appreciate it. It's really fun too.
Great.
Very much appreciate it.
All right, man. Always good. And I really hope that a lot of people that have listened to this episode, maybe they've heard of Nathaniel Greene, or maybe there's a number of people who've never heard of Nathaniel Greene, and now they have an appreciation for somebody who played such a pivotal role in the overall victory of the American Revolution, for our side, of course.
Well, you know, it's not talked about enough, and I am glad that Miss Baker is writing this book because, yeah, people need to know a lot more about who Nathaniel Greene is. He is barely mentioned in the movie The Patriot with Mel Gibson. There were a lot of players in that war that didn't, in my opinion, didn't get enough credit. Nathaniel Greene was one of them, and what's funny is that Daniel Morgan should have been mentioned a lot more because he's the one who won the Battle of Cowpens. So, you know, those two guys worked well together, and you know they did the, you know, she confirmed the Fabian strategy. They worked well with Washington and worked well with Nathaniel Greene because he knew that, you know, Cornwallis was a very powerful general. That he was a very smart general. He knew how to win battles. So rather than, you know, he didn't take him on until he knew he had enough muscle to take him on. And even then, Cornwallis still won. And that was at Guilford Courthouse.
Yeah, and it's, you know, Nathaniel Greene, I think a lot of people are like, well, how did the man feel about him? The man being Washington. George Washington loved Nathaniel Greene. Huge fan. And you can find a lot of writings. Like, even if you check out Ron Chernow's book on Washington, there's a lot of Nathaniel Greene mentioned in there. So just a great general. Sadly, you know, he died so early after the war was over. And you'd like to see that he got all of the debts and everything taken care of. But, you know, such is life, such is death. So what do you do?
Yeah, he didn't like live long enough to see the Constitution or his friend Washington being elected president.
Yeah, missed a lot, fought for a lot, missed a lot. And, you know, you got to wonder how he felt seeing how things were going under the Articles of Confederation, you know, to die and perhaps thinking, you know, we just fought this war and we won. It was a miraculous undertaking and an outcome. And now it looks like things are not really going to pan out, you know? So yeah, to your point, not getting to witness the creation of the Constitution and then Washington taking the helm and then everything panning out from there. So yeah, it's interesting, but I guess you'll never obviously know how he felt after that. But yeah, good stuff. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that book, The Line of Splendor, has recently come out. Go check it out. Go buy it on Amazon. Do our good friend Selena Baker a favor. And that will do. I wish you had perhaps something else to say, but I don't want to hear it because I got to get out of here, man. I love you, but I got to go.
I love you too. You know, I'm going to be rooting. Who are we playing? The Rangers?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll be rooting for the Rangers. Sorry.
No, don't apologize, man. Don't apologize. I don't need your apology. I don't need your sympathy. Much like...
Is that a song?
I don't know, but it's a phrase.
Well, you know, the Pink Floyd Eclipse song is still a better song, no matter what you throw at me.
Then Johnny Cash's Ring of Fire?
Well, okay, now...
Oh, I don't
no,
think so.
No, okay, down, you're right. I'm going to give Johnny Cash the credit. I do love Johnny fire, Cash. I love
the
Cash.
The Ring of Fire.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're welcome. So, and I love Pink Floyd, but no, Johnny Cash, me takes the... He takes first place. He takes first prize.
Yeah, but see, I never saw Johnny Cash in concert. I did see Pink Floyd in concert.
Yeah, did you see the pig fly across the...
I did. I saw them at the Houston Astrodome in 1987. I think it was Halloween 1987.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, my folks didn't know I was in town. I was going to A&M at the time. I drove into Houston, stayed with some friends, went to the concert.
Yeah, then definitely
went back
worth
to school.
Going to. That's an experience.
Yeah, mom and dad didn't know I was close by, so, you know.
Well, what mom and dad don't know won't hurt them, right? As, oh, man, I forgot his name. The guy who played Fonz on Happy Days.
Henry Winkler?
As Henry Winkler says on Tommy Boy, not Tommy Boy.
Waterboy.
Waterboy. Knew it ended with boy. What mama don't know won't hurt her.
Waterboy is probably one of the greatest sports movies. Better than Rudy. Better than...
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's no doubt about it. Yeah.
Great movie.
All right, man. I will chat with you later. Have a great week.
You too. Take care, bud.
All right, man.
Bye-bye.